This is the Past Lives podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Bown. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. To get access to the extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bown. And there is a Past Life Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. This week I'm talking to Kirsty Salisbury about near-death experiences. Kirsty had her own near-death experience at age 12, and she is an author, a coach, and host of the amazing Let's Talk Near Death podcast. So, hi, Kirsty. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It is wonderful to be here with you today. Thank you.
You had your NDE at 12 years old. So, could you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, sure. I'll start a little bit before the NDE. So, like you said, I was 12 years old. I was a competitive gymnast. I lived, breathed, everything I did was around this goal to really do quite well in gymnastics. It consumed me. So a couple of days before my near-death experience, I was at school and, like I said, it consumed me. So my lunch times were spent walking on my hands and jumping around and swinging on bars, things like that. So this day was just a completely normal day. I was in the playground at lunchtime and I was there with all my gymnastics buddies. We were swinging on the bars and I hit my head on the bar. Not significantly, not enough that I thought, uh-oh, there's a problem. I hit my head. It was a metal bar and I wasn't doing anything too fancy, but I literally just lost grip or something and my head went into the bar. Wasn't enough to think I need to go off to the sick bay at school or I need to get this checked out. I didn't have a headache. I literally thought that wasn't good and I went back to class when the bell rang. And then I noticed over the next few days that my head was sort of hurting a little bit. It never bruised. It was never significant. And then probably within, it was around about 48 hours, 24 to 48 hours. I can't remember exactly because it's quite some time ago now and quite a lot happened in that time. I remember just feeling quite lethargic, feeling tired and like I just wanted to have a rest basically. But I had this gymnastics competition coming up at the weekend. So I thought, well, I can't really rest. I've got to keep training for that. I'll rest just a couple of days before the competition. And then a few days before I went to bed. So this was probably now 48 hours after I'd hit my head. I went to bed early and drifted off to sleep, oblivious that things were about to change, that something significant was going to happen. And then I woke up in the night just a couple of hours later, and by that time everybody else had gone to bed. The house was quiet and I was lying alone in my room in the dark. And I noticed that I had this headache on the right-hand side of my head, and that wasn't something too fun for me. I hadn't had a lot of headaches in my life, but I remember very clearly how specific this headache was. It was like a pinpoint right up in my right-hand side of my head. And I can remember lying there thinking, I've never had a headache that is so specific, that is pinpoint pain like that. And then I started to not feel very well. So I thought, okay, I've got to get out of bed. I've got to go find a bathroom. You can read between the lines there. I got out of bed and I collapsed on the floor. And I thought that was very strange. I had this headache, which was getting worse all the time. It was a very extreme headache. It wasn't something light at all. It was consuming me now, the pain. And I'm lying flat on the floor next to my bed. So I try and stand up and I try and get myself out the doorway along the hallway to the bathroom. And I collapse on the floor again. And then I try and get up again, but this time I can't even get up off the floor. And I can remember very clearly putting my arm up onto the bed leg on the post and trying to pull myself up. And so as I did that, and I'm hanging onto the bed leg, and my body just can't stand up. Every time I get slightly off the ground, I crash again onto the floor, and I'm getting tireder and tireder. And then my mother comes into the room because she can obviously hear that there's been some crashing about, and she's probably thinking, what is she doing? She's probably doing her gymnastics training in the middle of the night, time to be sleeping. So she came in probably ready to tell me off. I'm not quite sure what her attitude would have been, but I'd made enough noise to wake her up. And she got me up, and I said, I have this terrible, terrible headache. It really, really hurts. I don't know what to do, and I feel really sick. So she helped me, and I can remember her sort of supporting my body and taking me through into our spare bedroom. And in the spare bedroom was big double beds. So we ended up spending the night there together. She stayed with me because I wasn't very well. And she lay on one side of the bed, and I was on the other side. And then I can remember hearing this voice. And this voice said to me, do not go to sleep. And I don't know where the voice came from. I remember it so clearly, but I'd never heard voices before. So I'm thinking, am I going a bit crazy? Because it was just so overwhelming. Do not go to sleep. So I'm there and my body is so tired. I am so tired. My head is pounding with pain on that tiny little spot where it hurts. And I'm trying to stay awake, and it gets harder and harder. The need to go to sleep is just consuming me. And I'm trying to stay awake because the voice has told me to, but I don't understand where the voice is, where it's come from, who it is, and why I need to stay awake. And so then I fell asleep. And the next memory I have, because I remember hearing the voice, the very next memory that I have is that I am in, all I can describe it as, is a place of nothingness. There is absolutely nothing there, but it's almost like there's an absence of nothing as well. So there's no sound, but it's not silent. There's no light, but it's not dark. It's just nothingness. And I'm there and I'm surrounded by this nothingness, and I'm trying to work out where I am, and I'm just sort of coming to terms with my surroundings. And then I can hear a voice. And the voice is different to the one that said, don't go to sleep. The voice is inside of me. It's in my ear. And yet it's right behind me on my right-hand side. And at the same time, it is galaxies away. And I can't explain. I know in English it doesn't make sense, but it was part of me and yet so separated from me all at the same time. And so the voice is my father's voice, which is extremely interesting because he was alive at the time. And my father's voice is there, and it's saying, you've got to squeeze my hand. You've got to do this. And I'm not quite sure why I need to do it. And I'm thinking, okay, I'll squeeze his hand. What's the big deal? And then I go to squeeze his hand, but I can't find his hand or my hand. And I never saw him. He was simply part of me, but separate to me, kind of slightly behind me on the right-hand side. And I'm looking everywhere for a hand to be able to squeeze his hand because I can hear him getting more desperate. I can hear him needing me to do a very simple task, in my opinion. And I just can't connect with him. I can't find him. I can't find my own hand. I can't find anything. And it's at that point that I start to wonder, what is going on? Where am I? And why can't I just do the things that I would quite easily do, you know, in my body beforehand. Before all this happened, if somebody wanted you to do something, you simply can just lift up your hand and do it. I had control over my body. But in this scenario, I had no control and it seemed almost like I had no body. So very, very confusing. And I'm starting to get this feeling of overwhelming responsibility that if I don't find a way to connect with him, that everything will not be okay, that the future as it needs to be, my world as I know it, the world, I'm not quite sure. It's just this overwhelming feeling of responsibility that if I didn't connect with him and squeeze his hand, things would never be okay or never be how they need to be. And so I keep trying. I'm getting more desperate because he's getting more desperate. I've got this responsibility feeling which is growing and growing. And I think I'm going to have to sacrifice myself for this, which sounds very big-headed. I'm aware of that. I'm going to have to die to fulfill this need. And so I remember thinking, I clearly remember counting down 3, 2, 1 and psyching myself up going, okay, this is what it must be like. I'm going to die for this. And I'm aware how crazy it sounds, but I did this. I counted down 3, 2, 1 and I kind of braced myself and I got ready to do whatever it took, give out as much energy as it took to connect with my father and to squeeze his hand. And so 3, 2, 1 and then as I go to do this, I give my absolute everything, every ounce of everything that I have. And then there's like a booming silent white light. So I'm aware that even that doesn't make sense. I'm engulfed in this most beautiful white light. And it's quite literally heavenly. It's welcoming me. And there's music and there's love and it's just radiating almost like a pulse, like a vibration. I can't explain it. It's just consuming me, this white light, and it's all around me and it's loving me. And then I notice that there's other people there. So within the distance, I get the feeling that there were so many people, like uncountable amounts of people, just so, so many people, and they're singing, and they're, it's almost like the music and the love that they're radiating is sending these waves of love and welcome to me. It's just the most amazing thing. But then I see that directly around me are these beings. And so there's probably about 7 or 8 of them. I didn't count at the time. It all happened so quickly. I was not aware of time. I was not aware of my physical body. I was no longer aware of my father at this point. I wasn't aware of trying to squeeze a hand. I wasn't in a body. I just was. I simply was in the moment. And there were these 7 or 8 beings around me. And they were cheering and clapping and they were celebrating the hardest. Much, much more than any of the other people in the distance. And so they were there and they were all about me. They were welcoming me and they were there for me and there was a connection to me. And again, sounds big-headed. I thought this was just the most amazing welcoming committee. I was blown away and I was thinking, I want to know who these people are. So my natural reaction was to try to look at them. And I noticed that I couldn't look at them. I couldn't see any facial features. I couldn't define who they were. They appeared very human to me, but at the same time, they were more than human. And so they're there. I'm trying to get a glimpse of their faces and I'm going around the group trying to identify who they are or just to look at them more to understand my scenario, what's going on here. And it was like they had no facial features. They were silhouette beings. But they were cheering and clapping and loving me, but I couldn't see any features. So I don't know what they were. I don't know who they were. The harder I tried, the more difficult it became to understand what they looked like. And I don't know whether I tried too hard and I sort of ran out of grace or something there. I don't know what it is, but the harder I tried, the harder it became. And then boom, I was back in my body. So I don't remember coming back into my physical body. The next memory I have after hearing the voice saying, do not go to sleep, I was then in the void in this place of nothingness. I was then in this white light. Next memory is I'm waking up in a critical care unit in the hospital and I've got tubes everywhere. I've got nurses, you know, rushing around me and giving me lots of attention. I've got people trying to explain what's happened to me and I'm now completely paralyzed down the left side of my body. So I wake up in the critical care unit. They're trying to explain to me that I've been very, very sick. And I know this already. I understand that I've been very sick. I know exactly what's happened. Not in like medical terms. I couldn't say exactly what happened. So what did happen was that I had an arterial venous malformation, which is an AVM. People more commonly know it as that, on my brain. So what that means in everyday terms is that my brain had a little malformation, slightly deformed before, well, actually probably not before I was born, but as I was growing up, I had this in my head. And obviously we knew nothing. I was a very active child. I did fine in school. I was just your normal kid with lots of energy, lots of energy. And so you'd never know that I had this problem in my head because you can't see your brain. You can't see that unless you're looking for something. You don't test for things like that. what we believe happened was the bang that I had to the head when I was on the bars in the lunchtime, when I hit my head, it quite possibly just jolted something or dislodged something or triggered something to happen. So this AVM, what can happen with them is that they can cause the blood flow to be, it can be difficult for the blood flow to keep going. It can build pressure up in the brain. So what happened for me is that the pressure built up so much that the brain vessels actually burst, and then I had a brain bleed. So the brain bleed, they rushed me in the next day. I'm all over the place, Simon. I'm so sorry. The next day after I heard the voice, and then when I was in the place of nothingness and I was having this experience, the next day my parents couldn't wake me up. So morning for school, they thought, okay, let's try and wake her up. Hopefully the headache's gone. She can go off to school. And I was in a very deep coma. They could not wake me. They couldn't get anything out of me. So they phoned the doctor and said, you know, doctor needs to come around to the house. Can't even get me to the hospital, to the doctor at the clinic. So they got an ambulance. The ambulance came, raced me straight off to the hospital, straight into emergency brain surgery, where they operated to remove this AVM. In the middle of the operation, I flatlined. The AVM was in a really difficult place for them trying to operate. They couldn't get to it easily. So in my medical records, it's there that I had to be resuscitated on the operating table. And that's simply because of the location of the AVM. And so then they brought me back again. They got me a little bit stable. And then the same thing happened. I flatlined again. And it was at that point that they realized the surgery was so dangerous that they couldn't continue because I probably wouldn't make it through. So they decided to abort the surgery. So when I woke up in the critical care unit, I've had surgery. So I've got a beautiful surgical scar. I'm now paralyzed down the left side of my body. I have people trying to explain to me what's happened, and I already know what's happened. And I already know that everything is exactly as it needs to be, that everything is perfect. And I don't know that I had fear. I mean, I was obviously quite concerned for my physical well-being, but I felt like everything was amazing. And I knew that the danger was over. I knew that I'd be okay, and that I just needed to get on with life. I knew there were going to be challenges ahead, but I also just knew that that was part of my journey and everything was perfect. So they're telling me what's wrong with me. I'm getting frustrated, and then I'm aware that I can actually feel different things and I have knowledge of things. I can see my parents getting in the car. And to me, it was quite normal to understand that. But then when I thought about it a little bit later, I'm thinking, but I'm in the hospital. How can I see that? And I knew exactly different things that were happening outside of my immediate location. And so that was happening. They were trying to calm me, and I'm saying, don't worry, everything's fine. We can pull the tubes out. I don't need this. I was like, relax, everything's going to be okay. And that sort of set the stage for the next little while, because I was never afraid to try things. I became really adamant that I was going to be okay. I knew that it was going to be tough, but I was going to be able to walk again. I was going to be able to do things, because the outlook didn't look too good. I was paralyzed. We didn't know the type of damage to my brain. Turns out that the little brain injury I have is very little, which is amazing. So they kept saying to me, your progress is just incredible. We can't believe how well you're healing, how well you've progressed. Whether there's something in that, I don't know. I wouldn't want to claim that there's any kind of miraculous healing or anything like that, but I'm certainly, you know, I've definitely wondered that behind the scenes. So that was pretty much my experience, really. So I hit my head, had this AVM, my brain bled. I had the emergency brain surgery, flatlined twice on the table, came back, had a full stroke, had the surgical scar, and had a whole new world to step into. And in terms of the experience, I really just didn't know what to do with that. I have only been talking about my experience for a very short time. I waited 27 years before I felt like I could do that. And even within that, it took another 3 years at the end there of me actually trying to talk about my experience. But it was too personal. It was too deep. It was something that I'd hidden for so long because I thought maybe I was a little bit crazy. I thought that maybe it was a little bit of brain damage or something like that. And I thought maybe the medications at the time had made me hallucinate something. So I don't believe that that's true, because my experience was so incredibly real. The other factor that I want to put in there is that I also woke up thinking, oh, so I had this experience and my father was there squeezing my hand and telling me, you know, let me know it's going to be okay. He was worried for me. So one of the first questions that I had for him was, Dad, were you there? Did you squeeze my hand? Were you trying to bring me back? And he looked at me and he said, no, sorry. And it turns out that he had found the whole experience so traumatic that he spent most of the time out in the waiting room that he couldn't actually sit with me beside my bed. But what he did say to me was, but this other person came in, and I'm not going to use her name, but she came in and she would sit with me every day for hours. And she would talk to me and she'd tell me about the family trip that they'd just been on. She'd share stories, read me things, spent all this time with me. And he said, do you remember her coming in? And I have no memory of it whatsoever. So really interesting. So it was at that point I thought, okay, this is a little bit bigger than what I thought it was. I couldn't explain it. And it was many years later when I first heard about a near-death experience that the penny kind of dropped. And I thought, that's what I had. I had one of those. So that's probably the long-winded version, actually, Simon. It's been a very interesting journey ever since. And my experience is something that I cannot shake. It has lived with me. The voice has come back to me many times. It's something that just completely shapes who I am today because I've come to terms with it.
So I've got so many questions. One of them is that you found yourself in a void that was just completely nothing. I suppose you can't even say it was darkness and black because it wasn't even that. But that sounds really scary, but you were like quite happy there?
I wouldn't say I was happy. I just was. When I woke up, I did describe it as black, but it had so much depth to it. It wasn't just a dark room. I've been in some very dark rooms since, and it's not like that. There was so much depth to it, and yet there was so much nothingness to it. And I'm aware that this doesn't make sense, but I didn't have fear. If I had an emotion, people have asked me, what is the emotion that you have? I'd probably say it was confusion, trying to work out, where am I? What is this about? What is happening? Why couldn't I find my body? That was probably the most concerning thing. Was where is this hand? Why can't I connect? Why can't I physically see my father? And trying to understand where he was, because like I said, he was in me, but he was external to me and so external to me. So I think probably the biggest emotion I had was confusion. I don't remember fear. I don't remember feeling threatened. I just was in that moment and trying to fulfill that need to find my father and connect with him.
And when you were in that space and throughout the near-death experience, did you have, because it's like you're going back to being a soul or a spirit, which would be much more knowledgeable. Did you feel like you had much more knowledge, that perhaps you were much more mature than a 12-year-old?
That's a really good question. I don't know if it came down to much more knowledge because, like I said, I had a lot of confusion. I wasn't really sure where I was or what was going on. But I do think people have often said to me since this experience, you seem to just know a lot of things. You seem to, have different ideas. My family would always say that my thoughts, my view on things was maybe a little bit older than what other people had at my age. But in terms of knowledge, no. But when I came back, I had that knowledge. I had this understanding and, you could call it a download, you could call it what you want, but I do feel like I returned with an element of understanding something, which I tapped into something and it lingered with me for quite some time. Some parts of it still linger with me. You know, we're talking 30 years later now, so quite some time, yeah.
And you still hear that voice even today. Do they help you out with things?
I hear the voice all the time. I question whether it's the exact same voice. I don't know. And I wanted to know, was the voice one of those people, one of those beings in that group that were directly around me? Is the voice God? What is the voice? But the voice speaks to me, and I think it's always spoken to me. I now open myself up to it, so I try and listen to the voice quite a bit. Because what I know is that voice has never, ever put me wrong. it challenges me and it pushes me. It makes me do things which I'm maybe not so comfortable to do. But the voice just, it always has the right answer. It guides me. It helps me to, I don't know, I guess live the most amazing life that I've got here. And so it could be really little things. You know, if I tune into that voice, it might be telling me to pick up the rubbish on the side of the road when I'm walking past with my dog. And like, that's not fun. We all know that that's not fun. And sometimes you want to run away from that voice. Other times it might be telling me you need to phone somebody and check in on them. And when you phone them, they're like, wow, I'm so glad you phoned. I'm really struggling. I've had such a hard time recently. And then you go, wow, if only I listened to that voice more often. Sometimes the voice will tell you to, not me personally, but it could be go and buy a, you know, a lottery ticket or something like that, and you get a win out of that. I'm not saying a huge win, but something. The voice just seems to pop up all the time. And it will challenge me. If I never know what to do in my life, I'll try and focus in. So you could call it God, you could call it Source, you could call it inner self. The voice is almost like it has so much more knowing and understanding than me. But, you know, it could be anything. I think everybody has a voice. I think everybody experiences it. Someone said to me recently, a really good analogy of it is it's when the phone rings and you know, oh, that's so-and-so before you pick up the phone, and you pick up the phone and sure enough, it's that person on the phone. It's just that little voice, but it's that little voice a little bit louder because I've trained it. But in the beginning, I hadn't trained it. So the voice was really trying to get my attention. It was trying to help me out with things, show me where to put my energy, my focus, what to do with my life, make decisions.
I suppose there are times it will, is it asking you to do something or is it telling you to do something? And because it said, you said that it said to you, you should do a podcast.
Yes, the voice did tell me. So I run the Let's Talk Near Death podcast. So after 27 years of holding in my own story and not wanting to talk publicly about near-death experiences and totally not wanting to do what I'm currently doing and loving, by the way, I was driving my car and I was minding my own business, simply just driving my car, and I'll never forget this exact moment. And I felt the voice come. You could say it was like a, yeah, download's the only word. I don't know. It's like this overwhelming feeling. And the voice said to me, I want you to go and share stories of near-death experiences. And I'm thinking, nah, I don't want to do that. No, that's not for me. And I'm trying to run away from it. And it came again, I want you to go and do this. And it's almost like when a parent tells a child off. And the child knows they have to do what the parent says, but they really don't want to. So if the parent's saying, okay, they need to go clean your bedroom, and the child's going, no, I don't want to, at the end of the day, the parent's the boss. The parent's going to, they need to clean the bedroom. So it's a little bit like that. I don't know if there's consequences if I don't do it. I assume that things won't go as well as they could do. So I'm driving my car, I get this feeling, and then I start to think, okay, what's the bare minimum that I could do to tick this off to get away with it? Just like a child would do. You know, maybe I can throw everything under the bed or put everything in the wardrobe to make the bedroom look tidier. Here's me driving my car thinking, I don't even know anyone who's had a near-death experience because I hadn't talked about it publicly. I'd kind of stood back in Facebook groups and I'd looked at things online, but I had never been active. I'd never been somebody who wanted to be known as somebody who looked into things like that. And so I'm thinking, how do I get out of this? And the voice then comes back and a little bit stronger. I don't know if you'd say it's louder, but more, yeah, stronger. And it says, actually, I want video. I want video experiences, people sharing near-death experience stories firsthand. And it was at that point that I knew that I could fight it. And I knew that I could do everything I could to hold back. But at the end of the day, just like the child needing to tidy the bedroom, I knew that I was going to have to do it if I wanted to have the best experience. And I've had this voice many times where I've run away from it and I haven't done what it said. And I've tried to be, you know it better and do things my way. And I never get to the place that I want to get to, or I end up coming all the way around to the beginning and then going, I should have just done it in the first place anyway. So that's where I decided with the podcast. So I said, okay, I'll talk to my husband. And I went home and I spoke to my husband and I said, oh, I think I've got something I need to do. And he's a little bit used to me coming up with new things because the voice directs me quite a bit. he's never really too fazed when I'm like, oh, I feel like there's this new thing on my heart that I have to do. So I said, I think I'm going to interview near-death experiences. And he just looked at me and he said, why wouldn't you do that? So I'm like, okay, well, there we go. Great. Now I have to actually do this thing. And the funny thing is I stepped into that not knowing anything. I went to put a post on a Facebook group thinking no one's going to do this. I'm going to get off the hook so easy. This is going to be so good because I'm not even going to find anybody who's had a near-death experience. I don't even know what to do. I don't know how to run a podcast. So I did that and then I got a huge response and the thing just took on life of its own. It grew wheels and people would listen to one and then they go, oh, well, I've had an experience. I'd like to talk and I'd like to talk and I know this other person who would like to talk. And it just took a life of its own and now is the most favorite part of my world. So I now do the Let's Talk Near Death podcast. It is my favorite part of my work that I do. I love connecting with all the guests. I have a wait list. So going from places where people didn't know, I didn't know anybody would had the experience to now I get requests all the time. And it is just the most amazing thing that I do. I love it and I love it. And I could never expect that that would have come. And I think, what would I do if I hadn't followed the voice?
Hello listeners, this is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. So you've done tons of interviews now. You've talked to so many people. Have you found that the whole subject of near-death experience is a lot more complicated than you thought it would be? And also the idea of distressing near-death experiences is kind of fascinating to me. And it really makes me wonder, why is it somebody would experience one and somebody else experiences something else? Because they all seem so personal.
They are very, very personal. They're very unique. So at the same time, they're all kind of similar. You've got the Grayson scale, which goes through all the different types. So the white light, the tunnel, and you can almost go through and tick off what you've had to determine your near-death experience. But then within those commonalities that we have, the experience itself is so unique and so different. It's so personal. So you're definitely right there. You ask a really great question. Why do they happen to some and not to others? And why are some distressing and some are full of love and light and wonderful experiences? I don't know. But what I do know is that I love to hear these experiences. There are so many themes that run throughout all the experiences. So I always ask people, why do you think this happened? And what do you think the big message is? The big message almost always comes back to love. That it's all about love, that love is the reason that we're here, love and learning and to exist. And if we can just infuse more and more love into what we're doing, everything gets better. So it's really interesting. I think, yeah, and people ask me, why did I have one? I don't know why I had a near-death experience. I was 12 years old. It wasn't that I had set ideas. Some people tell me in the interviews that they might have a near-death experience and they feel like it was their wake-up call, like they needed that wake-up call to kick them back into the right path to do what they needed to do in this lifetime and to live a better life that they had in front of them. I was 12 and so I didn't necessarily have set ideas. I didn't have a worldview. I didn't know anything about anything really. I was 12. I'd grown up in a very, I guess, atheist-based family life. And I didn't necessarily need to get me on the right track. I don't think that I'd strayed too far off that. So whether I needed to tap into this to pick up some extraordinary gifts or to receive something that would help me to be able to leave a better mark on the world or do some higher purpose work while I'm here, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of questions that go around as to why not, how, yeah, so many. And all I can say is there are very strong themes that I see, but you're right, they're so personal and it's really hard to understand what to do with them a lot of the time.
I wonder if before you're born, it's kind of a thing that's organized, and maybe for children. I talked to PMH Atwater recently about children that have near-death experiences, and it seemed like it's random. It's not like before their life, they said, right, what we're going to do is give you a near-death experience when you're 12, and that will set you up for later in your life when you're going to start doing these other things. But other times it seems like, you know, somebody will just have an accident, and then the spirit world looks at them and thinks, oh, look, quick, grab them. Let's give them a near-death experience. It's almost like it's staged for them as well. Because I talked to Nancy Rines many episodes ago, and she said that she found herself in this incredible landscape. And she was with a couple of people, she said, who were from her spirit team. And she looked behind her, and the landscape was just dissolving away into mist. And the spirits said to her, yeah, this whole place, we created it just for this near-death experience. It was like a stage set.
I've heard this before, actually, because everybody has a different experience, like we've already discussed. Some people will experience the nothingness, the void that I was in. Some people will walk around gardens. Some will be in glass buildings, like great big castles made out of glass walls, and they just sound absolutely amazing. Some will see flowers with different colours that don't exist here in this world. Other people see mountains. Other people don't see anything. They're simply in a state of something. So there's so much variety, which makes me wonder, is it related to the depth of the near-death experience? I will never know how long my experience took. You hear of experiences lasting up to 7 to 10 minutes, and those ones, they usually come back, and that's where they've had the full experience. They've had a life review. They've seen deceased loved ones or religious figures or whatever it is that they will connect with. But the idea that it is what we would relate to is amazing. So like you're talking about with Nancy, with the everything sort of just dissolving behind her, that would make sense to me, because that's where potentially she'd feel comfortable, or potentially it's her dream scenario. So when we're walking around this beautiful garden that I've heard of, maybe that is the most serene, most beautiful setting that we would imagine to have this experience in. And then also connecting with people. So some people connect with deceased people, with loved ones, with, like I said, religious figures. Maybe that's because that's what would make them feel more at ease. Maybe that's what would encourage them for their journey forward or even returning back. I think so much of it is what we would relate to, what would make us feel at ease or have the greatest experience.
Yeah, because that's what I wonder about. People that say they meet Jesus in this space. And I talked to somebody who on the podcast who did a lot of research into that, and they tried to find all the descriptions of Jesus to look for consistency, and there wasn't any. He was different ages, different heights, the hair color was different, the eye color was different. And it's that question, is this actually some kind of spiritual entity that knows that the best effect for you is to make you think that you've met Jesus and that'll set you on your life? Or is it actually Jesus? But, you know, this is the great thing about doing these podcasts and learning this stuff, is you never really find out. It's always a mystery.
Yeah, and I absolutely love that. I would love to take my research slightly wider. So the majority of the people that I've interviewed have been either in Western cultures, or they've been from very strong, perhaps Christian backgrounds where they will see Jesus. I've talked to people who don't see Jesus or some kind of figure that they would resonate with. Often that's because they either didn't have a belief system before the experience or they were young. So for me, I was still quite young. I don't know that Jesus would have had that connection. Jesus hadn't been a part of my life growing up. It was a very foreign concept to me. And then other people, I wonder if we were to go into more Eastern cultures or into other cultures with strong religious beliefs, whether they wouldn't see Jesus, they would actually see who's important to them because that's what they would connect with. And then I wonder whether it's actually all the same thing, because when we're in this world, in this realm, we've got everything associated with it. We've got all the dogma, we've got the, how do I say this? You know, we've got restrictions down here, we've got belief systems, we've got right and wrong, we've got all these different things that we put into it. But if we just strip everything away and bring it down to the essence of the belief, perhaps we would connect with a different figure, but it's the same essence. Have I even made sense explaining that, Simon?
Yeah, but then there's also the other side of things with somebody, say, like Howard Storm, who was almost an aggressive atheist, and he was saved from a distressing experience because Jesus lifted him up out of it. And that's what makes me think, well, he didn't have that belief, but that's what he would respond to the best.
So there are definitely scenarios like that. I've spoken to quite a few people who've had distressing experiences who say either they were completely off track, or they had no belief, or they were atheist. There are many, many testimonials out there of people who are atheists, and I'm talking very strong atheists, who then come back to become a priest or a minister or have the strongest faith in God because they're so transformed by the experience. So someone like Howard Storm, I know what you're saying. He said to me when I talked to him as well, it was, I believe if I'm recalling this correctly, he said that his life wasn't all that great. He was living very much a life for himself. And I would probably put him in one of those categories of where he talked about I needed to get back on track. So that's really different to somebody who has no belief system and ends up having a distressing one. But what I have seen in these distressing experiences is that there always seems to be a way out, that they don't seem to get stuck in that distressing place, and it's tormenting. It's just awful. When I hear the things that they've experienced, it's just, you know, it's quite frightening, it's quite awful, but there's always a way to get out of that, and many of them call on Jesus. Some of them, I spoke to a lady recently, she sung a Christmas carol, and that was enough to get her out. Someone else recited just a couple of words of the Lord's Prayer. And then I spoke to someone actually who had no concept of any of that, and they called out for their grandmother. And it was just connecting to their grandmother was enough to bring them out of the distressing experience. So not quite sure what there are. I've got different theories around different levels within the experience. So we go through different levels, and maybe those distressing ones is where you get stuck at some kind of level and you need to progress up through to the next level, to the next level. And as you go through, you might get up to the light. People will say to me, why do most people have the light experience? Why do people have the positive ones? I'm not sure that they do. I'm not sure that it's not just a case of we aren't hearing about the distressing ones because they are so traumatic, or that it's been something, like I said, for me, 27 years, so hard to talk about it, even on a positive one. If it has been traumatic, how do you start to broach that? How do you deal with that? What do you do with that? And so I don't know that the positive ones are more common. I just think that maybe we talk about them more.
Yeah. And also, if you had a distressing one, that could maybe cause some kind of PTSD and affect you quite badly if you didn't get out of it.
Absolutely. And I've heard a lot of stories of people having positive experiences and then having that PTSD. So I think it's Susie LeBun, actually. She had 2 years of PTSD after her experience, and she couldn't leave. She had to stay inside her house. She had to stay inside the room. I believe it was a hotel room that they were staying in because she was struggling so much. You hear stories that really, people really struggle to reintegrate once they've come back. They struggle to understand what to do with it, how to carry on with life. The other statistics are around the divorce rates, that they're quite high because people come back, and if they're already in a marriage when their NDE happens, or a relationship of some kind, they're so transformed by the experience that when they come back, often they can't come back exactly how they were. It takes quite a lot to be able to stay within that relationship, and a lot of them actually don't last because the person is so transformed. And it doesn't mean that the other person's at fault, neither people are at fault, it's just that things are now permanently different. So it's hard to know. There is a lot of PTSD that occurs within these experiences. Again, stuff we don't hear so much about. I have a lot of people tell me, oh, experience this is so lucky to have that experience, so lucky. And I think, well, hang on a minute. There is so much that goes on behind it from an emotional level, from a spiritual level. I mean, people are left with gifts that they really don't know what to do, that they can't necessarily always turn off. And so if they're coming back and they've got these amazing abilities to connect with loved ones or psychic abilities, or they can see things in the future, maybe they can see accidents happening and things going on. Yes, it's a beautiful gift, but if you don't know how to use it or you don't know how to manage that gift, that can be very, very intense. And so the PTSD is a very real thing for people coming back and reintegrating back into life, definitely.
Yeah, and there's also that thing where some people say they can't wear watches and they affect electrical devices, and they also have amazing synchronicities.
I hear this all the time, people who can't wear the watches because they just keep failing on them. Either the battery stops or the time's just slowing down, the battery's going down. They'll go and get a new watch. And then the same thing will happen. They think, gee, this watch, I've only had a little while, but it's broken. I'm going to have to take it back to the shop. So they take the whole watch back rather than just replacing the battery. And then the same thing happens. So they change the battery and the same thing happens. I've heard of a story, I think one lady took a watch back 3 times saying, you guys are selling me dud watches. Your batch of watches is not good because it keeps failing on me. And they're thinking, well, we've never had any other complaints from anyone else. And then over time, as you start to hear this, you realize actually it's to do with your electromagnetics within your body. It's interfering with the watch signal, so it's draining that battery, or it's just causing issues. I've heard stories of remote controls, TV controls not working or spontaneously working. So that's the scary one, is when it just suddenly turns on, the TV will turn on in the middle of the night or something like that. But also people walking under streetlights, and the streetlights will go out. And then as they move along, the streetlights come on again behind them. So it's wherever they are, it's short-circuiting something and the streetlights are going out or the lights are going out. There are so many examples. Radio, moving your hand around to change radio signals. I don't know whether it's connected to this, but I have a lot of quirky things happen with my car. Things like the indicators just start flashing. The clock changes time all the time while I'm driving. The radio comes on. I've connected into people's phone calls by sitting in my car through the Bluetooth. So the Bluetooth, it's got the phone system. It can connect so you can do phone calls through your phone hands-free. And I've been literally sitting in my car, and suddenly through the sound system, I'm connected to a phone conversation on someone's phone. And I'm going, I'm really sorry. I'm going to drive away. So I'll disconnect really soon. But it's the strangest thing. I don't know whether that's connected or it's just a bit of a, you know, a lot of fluky things. I've been through a few cars with electric problems, so I'm starting to really wonder whether that's part of it. But these things happen all of the time. So it's so, so interesting. I hear of so many interesting stories where things just don't work, or they're faulty, they're not working correctly, they're on either they're sped up or they're not working at all. So really interesting, yeah.
Did you have another surgery where you flatlined again, but you didn't have an NDE?
No, so I only had the one physical surgery where they operated on me, cut my head open, the emergency brain surgery. Because they aborted my surgery because I flatlined, then when I woke up, I had had the surgery, I'd had the stroke, but I still had the AVM in my brain. When they went in, they actually found that there was more than one. There was a couple of little problems, a few clusters there of problems. And so back then, I was kind of diagnosed as a walking time bomb, because at any point, the whole thing could happen again. So when I first woke up and I was thinking, don't worry, everything's perfect, I'm going to be okay, I felt invincible. And I was saying, take the tubes out, I'm okay, let's just get on with life. But actually, it was quite a dangerous situation in the physical, because I still had all these problems there and the whole thing could happen again, which they said very clearly, you will not survive. If you rupture again, you will not survive that. So in order to prevent that happening, I then had to live a very safe, quiet, stable life. And for somebody who was a competitive gymnast and called the Energizer Bunny by many people who knew her, because I was literally just bouncing off the walls. I was so high energy. I don't know how my family put up with me. To tell somebody to go from that to the point where I couldn't raise my heartbeat because that would put pressure on the brain. I couldn't raise my blood pressure because that put pressure on the brain. I had to basically just sit still and do breathing exercises. I just had to be as calm and as slow as possible. And this was not in my nature. So what happened is you ended up with a very frustrated 12-year-old, highly concerned that she might die at any instant. Because even though I knew I was going to be okay, when you hear it could happen and it's so dangerous and I wasn't allowed to go to school or anything, I was literally just stuck sitting calm. I started to believe everything that the doctors were saying to me, and that's a really core thing that happens for a lot of people. Rather than understanding that perhaps we can break out of our circumstances or that maybe that's not the truth, you know, they believe it's the truth, but actually the truth is that nothing was going to happen to me, but I didn't have that security. So I started to get very concerned that it was going to happen again. There were a lot of fears, and there was no way to go in and to operate again, because if they went in to operate, I wouldn't survive it. So the idea was, let's get her all stitched up. Let's get her okay. And then with the idea was that we would go and have the operation again, maybe a year and a half later down the track. But as time went on, we realized just how dangerous the situation was and that probably wasn't a good idea. We started to look at different alternatives. There was a treatment at that time, very, very new treatment called stereotactic radiation therapy. And I live in New Zealand. I was in Auckland Hospital when I was unwell. So I was here and this treatment was taking place in London. And so the idea was to take me from New Zealand over to London to have the stereotactic radiation therapy. And it was pretty new. We didn't know a lot about it. I was absolutely terrified. This was the only option to get rid of these because we couldn't see any other way. We're talking a long time ago before the medical advances and the technology that we have today. Today, if what happened to me happened to somebody, it's probably not a huge deal. But back then it was a really big deal because it wasn't very common. And I guess brain surgery was very, you know, still quite fragile back then. Not saying that it's not today, but it was a different level back then. So a year and a half after my initial surgery, I faced my fear, got on a plane. My mother went with me because it was just how it was. The rest of the family had to stay in New Zealand. It was too big to take the whole family. I was going to be away for just over 2 months for the treatment that I was having. We went there. We got given this beautiful trip to Disneyland. You know, when kids are really sick and sometimes they get trips and they get things. I was one of those kids, so I got a trip to Disneyland, which was utterly useless because it was on the way to the surgery. I'm in Disneyland. I'm now 13 and a half years old, and I still have to keep my heart rate stable, keep my blood pressure down, and do my breathing. And I'm in Disneyland, and it was just torture. I was like, why did we do this? By this stage, I could walk around a little bit. I'd get quite tired. But I could walk around. So my mother and I, we walked around Disneyland. I loved it. As frustrated as I was, I loved it. And then after a couple of days there, we flew on to the UK and went to London where I had my stereotactic therapy. And what that consisted of is that they had to attach something. They said, we've got two options. We can either bolt it into your head or we can attach it to your teeth. And I thought, well, neither of those options sound very good. But I went for the teeth option. I didn't fancy bolts being screwed into my head. So they attached this frame to my teeth. And from there, I was put onto a table. They bolted me to an operating table so that they could get the most precision radiotherapy that they could. I'm literally bolted to a table in a radioactive room, and they're sending these lights. It was like... they call it the gamma knife these days, I believe, but multiple beams of radiation to nuke the AVM within my brain. So I was there on the operating table and then nuking my brain, and it was so incredibly hot. And luckily, it went really, really well. So after 2 months of that, not of the Nuken was only a couple of things, but after 2 months of the whole trip and then the recovery, and then they had to do more angiograms and CT scans and different things to have a look at what the progress was, then I was allowed to fly back home. But every time I got on a plane, you know, I faced the fear because the cabin pressure, the altitude, would this kill me? You know, so many times in my daily life I was faced with, could this kill me? If I fell over, could that kill me? There were so many things that I could and couldn't do. And yet I was trying to live a most normal life as possible. And the whole time I'm very confronted with the spiritual experience that I've had. And I'm questioning a lot of different things. The first place that I went to when I was able to leave the house, this is well before the trip, I said, take me to church. I just want to go to church. And there was a local youth group around the corner. I went straight to that church and I didn't understand anything. I grew up in an atheist family. My parents were not too pleased that I wanted to go to church as the very first place. Went there and I can remember standing in the driveway and saying, God, I don't understand any of this, but I know that I had that experience. Can you, you know, here I am, use me, do what you want with me. I don't understand, but here I am. And that was really interesting because I had associated church with my experience. It was all I knew because it was so not of this world that was where I wanted to go. That was what I did. So I hadn't had, sorry, I've got the long way again. I do talk quite a bit. I hadn't had the second surgery wasn't invasive. It was invasive in terms of I didn't enjoy it, but it wasn't, I didn't have a surgical cut or anything like that.
I was going to ask you about your theory on people who have, say, heart attacks and do die and then are revived, but just have no near-death experience.
Yes, if I knew the answer to that, it would be wonderful. I think it comes back to the same question, why do some have it and why don't some have it? It's a really, really big question because when you've got that and they've gone into cardiac arrest, if that's a very definite point of death, which often it is, how could you not have the experience? So I do wonder whether some of it is that the experience isn't remembered. So for various reasons, either it's not going to be good for the overall purpose to remember the experience, or whether it's something to do with the brain's I don't even know how to explain this. The brain's unable to retain the information. So I know when we have experiences, and a lot of people who have had the near-death experience that I've interviewed myself, they talk about when they're in the experience, they have so much understanding and so much knowledge, and they feel like you could ask them anything and they would know the answer. Yet when they come back, it's almost like an amnesia. We forget that. And I think most of us are walking around in this realm with a state of amnesia because we don't understand the meaning of life. We don't know for sure why we're here. We don't understand our life purpose. You know, there's so many different levels of we've forgotten. But within these experiences, it's almost like we get it. We remember again. We understand, oh, that's right, I've been here before, or that's right, I was going down there to complete this certain thing. And when we come back, we forget it again. But we know that we remembered it. It's like when you know that you've forgotten something, but you can't remember what it is. It's a little bit like that, but probably a whole lot stronger. So somebody who's had a cardiac arrest and they've had a heart attack and it's very definite that they died, they come back, they can't remember anything. I would question whether they are being permitted to remember it, much like when I was looking at these beings around me and they've got no facial features and I wasn't permitted to know any more about them. Maybe they're not permitted to do that. Maybe they did have an experience, but it's too difficult to talk about. Like me, I shut it down. I put it in the too hard basket. Maybe it was a distressing one. And they don't talk about it because it's, again, too traumatic. So I don't know the answer. I think there's a lot of factors involved in that, Simon.
Yeah.
I think that maybe we don't have the full picture. Who knows? If you find out, let me know.
I asked Dr. Penny Sartori about this.
What does she say?
I suggested that maybe some people have a near-death experience because they need one. It's like the spirit world needs to give them a kick up the arse. But if their life's going just fine, maybe they don't need it. So from a spiritual point of view, you get one if you need one. But Dr. Penny Sartori said that she thinks it's the people just don't remember it for whatever reason. And I have heard of people who remember them, say 10 or 12 years later, it comes back to them that they'd had the near-death experience.
Yeah, that's something I've heard of quite a bit as well. When you don't know that you've had one, you suddenly remember it. So whether that's a dream, I interviewed someone just recently actually who had that years and years and years later, remembered as a child having this experience where the outside of their body, they knew the furniture, they knew everything. When they described it, somebody was able to say that's exactly what the room was like. So why does that happen? I don't know. Perhaps we're not allowed to remember or we're not permitted to remember because it's not going to do anything for us. It's not going to help us.
And I have heard, I don't know who's doing it, that there was a hypnotherapist who was hypnotizing people who had the cardiac arrest and no NDE and hypnotically regressing them back to that moment. And then they remember the NDE through hypnosis, which is something I'd like to find out more about that. But I can't find out who's doing it. I've just heard it's going on somewhere.
Yeah. It would make sense to me. Do you know if they remember it after the hypnosis session?
Yeah.
They would have to, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is so interesting because I wonder how much of it they remember, whether it's deeper or it's lighter or... Oh, so many questions with that one.
Do you find that your memory of your near-death experience is kind of pristine? Because I talked to Natalie Sudman about hers. And she said that it's almost like she could go back to it at any moment. She just said, I'm going to go back there. And she's back there in some way.
I can do that. It's a weird thing. It's like as soon as we're talking, even when I was describing it before, I was in that experience. I wasn't looking at it. I was describing it from being within it. And so I can just sort of go back in there. I don't have the same intensity, the emotional intensity, the feeling of connectedness that I did at the time. But the memory is very, very clear. I hear this all the time about how the NDEs are so, so real. And actually when I was talking to Dr. Eben Alexander, he said it's more real here. It was more real there than here. So for me, it's a very, very clear memory. And I can almost, it's not transport myself into it like Natalie Sudman. It's just... I'm there. I can remember it exactly how it was.
It's like it happened yesterday.
Yes, but at the same time, it's like, no, I think it's kind of when your children grow up and you go, oh, it's like just yesterday they were born. It's gone so fast. And then as you think about it, you're going, but actually that's gone quite slow. A lot has happened in that time. So it is just like yesterday, but at the same time, it feels forever ago. And again, I know that's kind of the theme with these, isn't it? That it never quite makes sense. You can never quite put it into words.
When you started out investigating other people's near-death experiences, you probably had some idea of what they're about, or you could guess. But were there things that came up, say you first hear about them and think, oh, no, that's just too much for me. That's crazy. I can't believe that. But now, after all this time, it makes sense and you can accept these crazy things.
Oh, definitely. In the early days, I would really go, oh, okay, that's interesting. I need to look at that more. And because I didn't have many pieces of the puzzle when I started, I really didn't. I'd had this voice tell me to go and do the podcast, go and interview people. I was simply doing what I was told. And that is my motivation behind this, is to follow that voice, which has turned into the most amazing thing. But in the beginning, I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge because it was too difficult for me. I wanted to run away from the whole topic. And as I started to learn of more and more stories, it was like I got more pieces to the puzzle. And the more pieces you get, if you're doing a jigsaw, you can suddenly see, oh, well, that could be a tree or that could be a house or that could be that. As you receive more pieces of the puzzle, the understanding gets bigger. And that is where I realized just how enormous this topic is. It is not just the near-death experiences. We talk about all sorts of things, and you touched on briefly about whether we choose to have the experience. And when you said that, I'm like, oh yes, we could talk soul groups, we could talk exit points, we could talk purpose, we could talk, you know, pre-planning, pre-birth memories. There are so many big topics within this topic. So in the early days, there were some things which really fazed me, but it wasn't, oh, I think this person's, you know, they're sandwiched short of a picnic. It was nothing like that. It was, I have so much to learn. Wow, this is super interesting. So I think when I came across these things, I'm going far out. That's just so beyond what I can understand right now. I guess I just parked it to one side. And then the more and more times that I heard of that particular thing, or the more that I went and researched, often I'd just get on Google and ask Google pretty much anything. And my history must be very unusual if anybody looked at my Google history, you know, my searching. So I would just learn and absorb. But the more I learned, I'd get another piece of the puzzle, and then that would open up another topic, and then another topic, and another topic. So I feel like it's almost like a puzzle with no borders. If I get a jigsaw puzzle, I always do the outside first because that seems the most logical thing. It's the easiest part. But I feel like this research that I've been doing and listening to, you know, it's over 100 interviews. I've connected with literally thousands of experiences out there. I feel like there are no borders because every topic is so enormous and yet it all still falls under the same umbrella. They all interlink somehow. So when I hear something that just seems a little bit too out there, a bit crazy, I just park in and go, okay, I don't have the other puzzle pieces right now, but let's hope they come because that's really interesting.
Yeah. And the one thing that surprised me is when people mention ETs, because I had a great interest in UFOs and I had a great interest in the afterlife, but I didn't really see them connected at all. But then little things crop up, and I saw... when I talked to PMH Atwater about children who had near-death experiences, and it says in her book that 5 to 10% of the children report encountering ETs during their near-death experience. And there's something in the book I'm reading at the moment of Whitley Strieber, who, you know, he's a big kind of alien abduction story. He's also talking about, he said that he had this cabin in New York State that was out in the woods. It wasn't in the city or anything. And that occasionally these ETs would come. He called them the visitors. And he says more often than not, the dead would come with them. And so there's another connection there. And so I'm starting to see that. And that is a bit of it's sort of a brain freeze. It's like, holy moly, how did this come into it?
Exactly. And that's another example of the puzzle just grew a whole nother part to it, a whole nother topic. I find it interesting when you talk about the children having the near-death experiences and they have the ET within that. Is that because they're children and that's what they're exposed to? I don't know. Is it, you know, that when we're children, our brains are a lot more malleable, our brains are a lot more open to different things? Is it because as we grow older, we don't allow ourselves to experience things like that so much because that's outside of what we believe is necessarily real? If we're more open to that, does that mean we're more likely to experience it? So many questions.
Yeah. And I wonder if you ask those children to describe the ETs that they have contact with or they see, if they're describing consistently, all the children say the same thing. And like they may never have seen this type of alien on TV or anywhere, but they're all, you know, that I look for those sort of consistencies because it's kind of verification. But it's weird to say they're verifying aliens in the astral plane, which is such, would have sounded like such madness to me 20 years ago.
Yeah, perhaps. But then if you look at the experiences, so if I talk about near-death experiences and then we travel over to a slightly different fringe topic of that around soul groups and did we plan in the experience before we came, then you've got your soul groups. And your soul groups, are they all incarnating on Earth? And then that goes into different, you know, different galaxies, different timelines. Then we go into parallel universes where I've heard about near-death experiences and people living, you know, timing's not matching up for birth and death dates. So there's an element of parallel living there. when you consider all of these things, and we're talking about multi-dimensional realities, so different, we're talking about different planets, different worlds, it doesn't faze me anymore. Whereas it is all connected to the near-death experience, because everything's connected to everything. So when we've got ET experiences and people saying, well, I had a near-death experience and now I'm more open to this and now this is happening, is it because that got opened through the near-death experience? Did a near-death experience become more likely because they had the ET experience? Is one of these an exit point which we have throughout our life when we can choose a time when actually we have the option to finish our life? It's not intentionally, it's not like suicide, but we have these opportunities throughout life. Are these experiences exit points which maybe have gone a little bit skew with, or, you know, it is all part of the same conversation. Nothing fazes me.
We could go on forever, and it's almost like we could do a whole podcast series and then choose one subject for each conversation, and because it gets so complicated.
Maybe we need to do that.
Yeah. But tell us about your books and your website and the other work you do.
So pretty much everything that I do is up on my website, which is kirstysalisbury.com. I've then got the Let's Talk Near Death podcast, which is at letstalkneardeath.com. And this is my primary focus doing the podcast because I want to follow the voice. Within that, I do lots of different things. I do a lot of different coaching. So whether that's life coaching, I do death coaching as well. So people who are either at the end stages of their own life and really struggling or wanting to talk that through, so maybe they've received a terminal diagnosis or they've got an illness or they're just at a later stage in life talking through that, or perhaps it's someone who's had a diagnosis within their family. So the family members got really sick, they've been told they're terminal and the family don't know how to quite deal with that. Maybe it's the partner who wants to chat. So that would be what I class death coaching. I then talk quite a bit about end-of-life care. So I've got a program called Dying Well, which is all about planning and preparing for the end of life. It's a practical guide, but it also considers your personal belief systems, things like that. I do a lot of different things. I do a lot of speaking, podcasting, obviously, the coaching, and I'm also a registered funeral celebrant. However, I'm more involved in, I love the living side of funerals rather than the actual after-death part. I prefer to work with people before they die. So there's lots and lots of different things I do. I've got my hand in a lot of different pies. I love variety. I'm not somebody who can stay very contained. Like I say, it's the energy again, just bouncing all over. But I love to hear from people. So if anybody wants to get in touch, they're very, very welcome to do so.
And your book is it Design Your Life? And you have Let's Talk Life Design.
I've got A Life by Design, which is my story. So pretty much what I covered today and then the key lessons that I learned through that. Because I learned that our circumstances continuously change and that we can't be confined to our current circumstances. So my story is A Life by Design. It's got my personal journey at the beginning and then it goes into these lessons that I learned and how we can actually upgrade our life going forward. Suitable for anybody. And then Let's Talk Life Design is about other people coming through crisis moments. So not so much around the near-death experience itself, but how to navigate when life is really tough, get a diagnosis, have an accident, lose a loved one, all of these major things. How do we progress and live life after that?
Right, excellent. Okay, well, thanks for being a guest. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Simon. I've so enjoyed just chatting. It's been great.
And that was a great interview with Kirsty Salisbury. Now, a great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast. Or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.